What if I'd rotted? What if you couldn't wake me? Then your uploaded persona would inherit your responsibilities and authority, Eliza replied. And then, as if remembering that it was supposed to show a human face, but I am glad that has not occurred.
You don't know what glad means.
But even as she said this, Kern was not sure that it was true. There was enough of her smeared up that continuum towards the life electronic that perhaps Eliza knew more of human emotion than Kern herself was now left with.
Proceed with the next phase. Of course, proceed with the next phase.
She snapped into the silence that followed.
What else are we here for? What else is there?
In a very real sense indeed, what else is there? She remembered when the false humans, that disease that had outlived her people, had approached the planet. Had they? Had that actually happened? She had spoken to them. The her that had interacted with them must have recognized enough humanity in them to bargain, to spare them, to allow them to rescue their own. Each time she was awoken, it seemed some different assortment of thoughts took the helm of her mind. She had been in a giving vein then. She had recognized them to be human enough to show mercy to. She had been sentimental that day. Thinking back on it, she regained those memories of how it had felt. And they had been as good as their word, she assumed, and they had gone. There was no sign of them, or of any transmissions, within the solar system. She had an uncomfortable feeling that it was not that simple. She had a feeling that they would be back. And now she had so much more to lose. What devastation would those false humans wreak on her nascent monkey civilization? She would have to harden her heart. Phase two of the uplift program was a contact exercise. Once the monkeys had developed their own singular culture to the extent that they could send radio transmissions, they were ready for contact with the wider universe. And now I am the wider universe. The sentry pod would begin developing a means of communication, starting with the simplest binary notation and using each stage to bootstrap up to a more complex language, just as if a computer was being programmed from scratch. It would take time, depending on the willingness and ability of the monkeys to learn generation to generation. But first, send them a message, Avrana decided. For all that the inhabitants of the planet could not possibly understand her, right now she wanted to set the tone. She wanted them to understand what they were in for when she and they could finally communicate.
Awaiting your message, Eliza prompted. Tell them this, Avrana declared.
Perhaps, in their simian ignorance, they would record it and later reread it and understand it all.
Tell them this. I am your creator. I am your god.
Part 5. Schism. Chapter 5.1. The Prisoner. Holston was pondering his relationship with time. Not long ago, it seemed that time was becoming something that happened to other people, or, as other people had then been in short supply, to other parts of the universe. Time was a weight that he seemed to have been cut free from. He stepped in and out of the forward path of its arrow, and was somehow never struck down. Lane might call him old man, but in truth the span of objective time that had passed between his nativity and this present moment was ridiculous, unreal. No human ever bestrode time as he had done, in his journey of thousands of years. Now, in his cell, time weighed him down and dragged at his heels, chaining him to the grindingly slow pace of the cosmos where before he had leapt ahead across the centuries, skipping between the bright points of human history. They had hauled him from the suspension chamber and thrown him in this cage. It had been 27 days before anyone gave him even an indication of what was going on. At first, he thought it was a dream of the mutineers kidnapping him. He had been quite sanguine before he realized that the people dragging him through the Gilgamesh were not the long-dead Skulls and company, but total strangers. Then he had entered the living quarters. The smell had assailed him. an utterly unfamiliar, sick reek that even the gill's ventilation had not been able to purge. It was the scent of close-packed human habitation. He had a blurred recollection of a former operations room, now festooned with grey cloth, a veritable shanty town of makeshift drapes and hangings, and close partitions and people, lots of people. The sight had shocked him. Some part of him had grown comfortably used to being part of a small and select population, but he registered at least 100 unfamiliar faces in that brief moment. The press of them, the closeness of their living conditions, the smell, the sheer raucous noise, all of it merged into the sense of confronting a hostile creature, something fierce and inimical and all-consuming. There had been children. His wits had started to come to him by then, with the thought, "The cargo's got loose!" His captors all wore robes of the same sheer grey material that the squatters were also using for their amateurish tents, something that the Gilgamesh had presumably been storing for some other purpose entirely, or that had been synthesized in the workshops. Holston had spotted a few ship suits during his hurried passage through the living quarters, but most of the strangers had been wearing these shapeless, sagging garments. They were all thin, malnourished, underdeveloped. They wore their hair long, very long, past the shoulders. The whole scene had a weirdly primal feel to it, a resurgence of the primitive days of mankind. They had seized him, locked him up. This was not just some room in the gill that they had secured. Within one of the shuttle bays they had welded together a cage, and this had become his home. His captors had fed him and sporadically removed the pail provided for his other functions, but for 27 days that was all he had. They seemed to be waiting for something. For his part, Holston had eyed the shuttle airlock and begun to wonder if his future did not include some kind of space god sacrifice. Certainly the manner of his captors was not simply that of oppressors or kidnappers. There was a curious respect, almost reverence, to be observed amongst some of them. They did not like to touch him. Those who had manhandled him to the cage had worn gloves, and they refused to meet his eyes. All this reinforced his growing belief that they were a cult, and he was some sort of sacred offering, and that the last hope for humanity was even now vanishing away beneath the tide of superstition. Then they set him to work, and he realized that he must surely be dreaming. One day, he woke up in his cell to find that his captors had brought in a mobile terminal. A poor, lobotomized sort of a thing, but at least a computer of sorts. He leapt on it eagerly, only to find it linked with nothing, entirely self-contained. There was data there, though, files of familiar proportions written in a dead language that he was frankly coming to loathe. He looked up to find one of his captors peering in. A thin-faced man, at least a decade younger than Holston, but small-framed like most of them, and with pockmarked skin suggesting the aftermath of some manner of disease. As with all these bizarre strangers, he had long hair, but it was carefully plaited and then coiled at the back of his neck in an intricate knot. "You must explain it." It was the first time any of them had spoken to Holston. He had begun to think that he and they shared no common language. "Explain it," Holston repeated neutrally. "Explain it so it can be understood. Make it into words. This is your gift."
"Oh, for... you want me to translate it?"
"Even so."
"I need access to the Gill's main systems," Holston stated.
"No."
"There are translation algorithms I wrote. There are my earlier transcriptions I'll need to refer to."
"No. You have all you need in here." With great ceremony, the robed man pointed at Holston's head.
"Work. It is commanded."
"Commanded by whom?" Holston demanded.
"Your master."
The robed man stared coldly at Holston for a moment, then suddenly broke off his gaze, as though embarrassed.
"You will work, or you shall not eat. This is commanded," he muttered. "There is no other way."
Holston had sat down at the terminal and looked at what they wanted from him. That was the beginning of his understanding. Obviously, he was dreaming.
he was trapped within a dream. Here was a nightmarish environment, both familiar and unfamiliar. Here was a task without logic that was nonetheless the cracked mirror of what he had undertaken when last awake, when the Gilgamesh had been in orbit over the grey planet. He was in the suspension chamber still, and dreaming. But of course, one did not dream in suspension. Even Holston remembered enough about the science to know that. One did not dream because the cooling process brought brain activity to an absolute minimum, a suspension of even the subconscious movements of the mind. This was necessary because unchecked brain activity during the enforced idleness of a long sleep would drive the sleeper insane. Such a situation arose out of faulty machinery. Holston remembered clearly that they had lost human cargo already. Perhaps this is how it had been for those martyrs. It was a strangely calming revelation to know that his suspension capsule must be failing at some deep mechanical level, and that he was lost inside his own mind. He tried to imagine himself fighting with the sleeping chamber, crawling up the steep incline of ice and medication so as to wake up, beating on the unyielding inside of the coffin, buried alive within a ship-shaped monument to mankind's absurd refusal to give up. None of it got the adrenaline going. His mind stubbornly refused to leave that makeshift cell in the shuttle bay, as he worked slowly through the files he had been left with. And of course it was a dream, because they were more of the same. More information about Guyan's machine, the upload facility the man had wrenched whole from the abandoned terraform station. Holston was dreaming an administrative purgatory for himself. Days went by, or at least he ate and slept and they slopped out his pail. He had no sense of anything functional happening outside the cage. He could not see what these people were for, save living day to day and forcing him to translate and producing more of themselves. They seemed a weirdly orphan population, like lice infesting the Ark ship, that the Gill might any moment purge from its interiors. They must have begun life as cargo, but how long ago? How many generations? They continued to regard him with that curious reverence, as though they had caged a demigod. It was only when they came to shave his head that he fully understood that. They, none of them, seemed to cut their hair, but it was important to them that his scalp was cropped back to fuzz. It was a sign of his status, his difference. He was a man of an earlier time, one of the originals. As is Vri Guyan. The unhappy thought finally dispelled his somewhat fond thought that this might all be some hibernation nightmare. Wading his way through tangled philosophical treatises concerning the implications of the upload process, he had a window into Guyan's tightly clenched, control-hungry mind. He began to assemble the sketchiest possible picture of what might be going on, of what might have gone wrong, therefore. Then one day they opened his cage, a handful of robed figures, and led him out. He was not finished on his current project, and there was a tension about his keepers that was new. His mind immediately boiled with all manner of potential fates they could be intending for him. They moved him out of the hangar and into the corridors of the Gilgamesh, still not speaking. They seemed to lack the show of reverence in which they had previously held him, which he reckoned could not bode well. Then he saw the first bodies. A man and a woman collapsed in their path like string-cut marionettes, the textured floor sticky with a slick of blood. They had been hacked at with knives, or at least that was Holston's impression. He hurried on past them, his escorts, captors, paying no obvious heed to the dead. He tried to question them, but they just hauled him along quicker. He considered struggling, shouting, protesting, but he was scared. They were all solidly made people, bigger than most of the grey ship lice he had observed so far. They had knives in their belts, and one had a long plastic rod with a blade melted into the end. These were the ancient tools of the hunter-gatherers remade from components torn from a spaceship. It had all been handled so swiftly and confidently that only right at the end did he realise that he had been kidnapped, wrested from one faction by another. At once, everything became worse than he had thought. The Gilgamesh was not just crawling with crazy descendants of awoken cargo, but they had already begun fighting each other. It was the curse of the old empire, that division of man against man that was the continual break on human progress.
He was hustled past sentries and guards, or so he took them to be, men and women, some in ship suits, some in makeshift robes, others in piecemeal homemade armour, as though at any moment someone would be arriving to judge the world's least impressive costume competition. It should have been ridiculous. It should have been pathetic. But looking into their eyes, Holston was chilled by their steely purpose. They brought him into one of the ship's workshop rooms, housing a score of terminals, half of them dead, the rest flickering fitfully. There were people working on them, real technical work befitting real civilized people. And it looked to Holston as though they were fighting for control, engaged in some colossal virtual battle on an invisible plane. At the far end of the room was a woman with short-cut hair, a little older than Holston. She wore a ship suit that had been fitted out with plastic scales and plates, like somebody's joke idea of a warrior queen, if only she had not looked so very serious. There was a ragged, healed scar about her chin, and a long pistol was thrust through her belt, the first modern weapon Holston had seen. "Hello, Holston," she said, and his interpretation of what he was seeing suddenly flipped like a card turning over. "Lane?" he demanded. "Now you've got that look on your face," she observed, after giving him enough time to get over his surprise. "That one that's sort of, I have no idea what's going on. And frankly, I can't seriously believe that. You're supposed to be the smart guy, after all. So how about you tell me what you know, Holston?" She sounded partly like the woman Holston remembered, but only if that woman had been living hard and rough for some time. He gave the request due consideration. A lot of him genuinely wanted to disavow any knowledge. But she was right. That would be self-serving mendacity. "I'm just a poor academic doing what I'm told. I'm not responsible." He was beginning to think that he was indeed, in part, responsible. Responsible for whatever was happening now. "Guyon's taken over," he hazarded. "Guyon's the commander. He's already, what, over? Come on, Holston." "He's woken up a whole load of cargo." Holston glanced at Lane's villainous-looking crew. Some of them he thought he recognised as her engineers. Others could well be more of the same cargo that Guyon had apparently now pressed into service. "I guess he started on that a while ago. Looks like there may be 2-3 generations down the line. Is that even possible?" "People are good at making more people," Lane confirmed. "Fuckwit never thought that one through. Or maybe he did. They're like a cult he's got. They know fuck all but what he's told them, yeah? Any of the originals from Cargo who might have argued, they're long gone. These skinny little creeps were basically raised on stories of Guyon. I've heard some of them talking, and they're fucked up, seriously. He's their saviour. Every time he went back into suspension, they had a legend about his return. It's all kinds of messianic shit with them." She spat disgustedly. "So tell me for why, Holston." "He had me working on the upload facility taken from the station." A little of the academic crept back into Holston's unsteady tones. "There was always a suggestion that the ancients had found out how to store their minds electronically. But the EMP phase of their war must have wiped the caches out, or at least we never found any of them. There's very little that's even peripheral reference. It didn't seem to be a standard immortality trick." "Oh, spare us," Lane broke in. "So yes, Guyon wants to live forever." Holston nodded. "I take it you're not in favour." "Holston, it's Guyon. Forever. Guyon, forever. Two words that do not sit well together." He glanced at her confederates, wondering if things here in Lane's camp had got to the point where dissent was punishable. "Look, I understand it's not the most pleasant idea, but he's got us this far. If he wants to load his mind into some piece of ancient computing, then are we definitely sure that's something worth, you know, killing people over?" Because Holston was still thinking a little about those crumpled bodies he had seen, the price of his freedom. Lane put on an expression to show that she was considering this viewpoint.
Sure, fine, right. Except two things. One, I only got one look at his new toy before he and I had our falling out. But I don't reckon that thing's a receptacle for minds. It's just a translator. The only place he can go is the Gilgamesh's main system. And I seriously do not think that it's set up to keep doing all of its ship running with a human mind shoved into it. Right?
Holston considered his relatively extensive understanding of the upload facility.
Actually, yes, it's not a storage device, the thing we took from the station. But I'd thought he'd got something else from there.
And have you seen any of your old files that suggest he has?
A grimace.
No.
Right. Lane shook her head.
Seriously, old man. Did you not think about what it was all meant for, when you were doing his work?
Holston spread his hands. That's unfair. It was all... I had no reason to think there was anything wrong.
Anyway, what's your second thing?
What? Two things, you said. Two reasons.
Oh, yes. He's completely nutbucket crazy. So that's what you're diligently working to preserve. An utter god complex lunatic.
Guyan? Yes, a bit of a tyrant, but he had the whole human race in his hands.
Yes, not an easy man to work with, someone who kept his plans to himself.
Lane, I know that you and he...
don't get on?
Well, Holston, he's been busy. He's been busy for a very long time since we left the Grey Planet. He's set up his fucking cult and brainwashed them into believing he's the great hope of the universe. He's got this machine mostly up and running. He's tested it on his own people. And believe me, that's not gone well, which is why it's still only mostly up and running. But he's close now. He has to be.
Why has to be?
Because he looks like he's a fucking 100, Holston.
He's been up and about for maybe 50 years on and off.
He told his cultists he was God. And when he woke up next time, they told him he was God, and that little loop has gone round and round until he himself believes it. You see him after they woke you?
Just his people.
Well, believe me, any part of his brain that you might recognise abandoned ship a long time ago.
Lane looked into Holston's face, hunting out any residual sympathy there for the commander.
Seriously, Holston, this is his plan. He wants to put a copy of his brain into the gill. He wants to become the Gill. And you know what? When he's done it, he won't need the cargo. He won't need most of the ship. He won't need life support or anything like that.
He's always had the best interests of the ship at heart, said Holston defensively.
How do you know?
Because it's already happening.
Do you know what the ship was not designed for? Several hundred people living on it for about a century. Wear and tear, Holston. Like you wouldn't believe. A tribe of people who don't know how anything actually works, getting into places they're not supposed to be, buoyed up by their sincere belief that they're doing God's work. Things are falling apart. We're running out of supplies even with what we took from the station. And they just go on eating and fucking because they believe Guyan will lead them to the promised land.
The Green Planet, Holston said softly.
Maybe he will.
Oh, sure, Lane scoffed. And that's where we're heading, all right. But unless things get back under control and people go back to the freezer, Guyan will be the only one to get there. Him and a ship full of corpses.
Even if he does manage to upload himself, he'll need people to fix him.
Holston wasn't sure precisely why he was defending Guyan, unless it was that he had long made a profession out of disagreeing with just about every proposition put in front of him.
Yeah, well... Lane rubbed at the back of her neck. There was all that auto-repair system business we took from the station.
I didn't know about that.
It was priority for my team. Seemed like a good idea at the time.
I know, conniving at our own obsolescence.
It's up and running too, or looks like it. But from what I saw, it's not dealing with the cargo or even most of the systems we need. It's only set up for those parts of the ship Guyan's interested in, the non-living parts. Well, that's the best impression I got before I took my leave.
After Guyan woke you.
He wanted me to be part of his grand plan. Only when he gave me access to the Gilgamesh, I found out too much, way too fast. Some seriously cold stuff, Holston, I'll show you.
You're still in the system?
It's all over the ship, and Guyon's not good enough to lock me out. Now you're wondering why I haven't screwed him over from inside the computer.
Holston shrugged. Well, I was, yes, actually.
I told you, he's been testing the upload thing. Well, he's had some partial successes. There are things in the system. When I try and cut Guyon out, or fuck with him, they notice me. They come and start fucking right back. Guyon I could handle, but these are like retarded little AI programs that think they're still people. And they're Guyons, most of them.
Most of them? Lane looked unhappy, or rather unhappier.
Ah, everything's going to crap, Holston. The Gill's already starting to come apart at the system level. We're on a spaceship, Holston. Have you any idea how fucking complex that is? How many different subsystems need to work properly just to keep us alive? At the moment, it's actually the auto-repair that's keeping everything ticking over, rerouting around the corrupted parts, patching what it can. But it's got limits. Guyon's pushing those limits, diverting resources to his grand immortality project. So we're going to stop him.
So, Holston looked from Lane to her crew, the old faces and the new.
So, I know about the upload facility, so you got me out.
Lane just looked at him for a long moment, fragments of expression burning fitfully across her face.
What? She said at last. I'm not allowed to just rescue you, because you're my friend.
She held his gaze long enough that he had to look away, obscurely ashamed of what was objectively an entirely reasonable paranoia he felt about her, about Guyon, and about near enough everything else.
Anyway, get yourself cleaned up, get yourself fed, she instructed him.
Then you and I have an appointment.
Holston's eyebrows went up.
With who?
Old friends, Lane smiled sourly. The whole gang's together again, old man. How about that?
Chapter 5.2 In God's Country.
Portia stretches and flexes her limbs, feeling the newly hardened sheen of her exoskeleton and the constricting net of the cocoon she has woven about herself. The urge came at an inconvenient time, and she put it off as long as she could. But the cramping tightness at every joint had eventually become unbearable, and she was forced to go into retirement, a moon's span of days out of the public eye, fretting and fidgeting as she split her way out of her cramped old skin and let her new skeleton dry out and find its shape. During her lying in, she has been attended by various members of her peer house, which is a dominant force now in Great Nest. There are two or three others who, as a union, could challenge the hold of Portia's family, but they are seldom friends with one another. Portia's agent provocateur ensure that they are kept constantly fighting over second place. The political realities of Great Nest are finely balanced just now, however. Despite the reports brought to her daily during her lying in, Portia knows there will be dozens of key pieces of information that she will have to catch up with. Thankfully, there is a ready mechanism for doing that. Portia is the greatest priestess of the messenger that Great Nest has. But a month out of circulation will have given many of her sisters ideas. They will have been talking to that fleet, all-important light in the sky, receiving the bizarre, garbled wisdom of the universe, and using it for their own benefit. They will have been taking over the grand, often incomprehensible, projects ordered by the voice of God. Portia will have to jostle to recover her old prominence. She descends to the next chamber, a gaggle of younger females attending her. A flicker of her palps and a male is brought in. He has lived a busy month and been present at gatherings that his gender are usually banned from. Everywhere that Portia might have gone, he was brought by her adherents. He has had every missive, every discovery and reversal, every proclamation of God patiently explained to him. He has been well fed, pampered. He has wanted for nothing. Now one of the females brings forward a bulging bulb of silk. Within is the distilled understanding that the last month has added to this mail. It comprises an intelligence report which, if delivered in any conventional way, would be interminable in its detail. That single draft contains enough secrets of Portia's peer house to hand Great Nest on a platter to any of her enemies. She drinks, the fluid thick with learning, the bulb held within her palps as she carefully drains its contents before passing it to her subordinates to be destroyed. Already she feels a flutter of discord inside her as the nanovirus she has just ingested begins to fit the purloined knowledge into place within her own mind, accessing the structure of her brain and copying in the male's memories. Within a day and a night she will know all that he knows, and likely she will have lost some unfrequented mental pathways too, some obsolete skill, or distant recollection reconfigured into the new and the necessary. I will send word about him. She indicates the mail. Once she is sure that the new understandings have taken, the mail will be disposed of. Killed and eaten by one of Portia's clique. He knows too much, quite literally. Portia's society has come some way since the primitive days when the females ate their mates as often as not, but perhaps not so very far. The killing of males under the protection of another peer house is a crime that demands restitution. The needless killing of any male garners sufficient social disapprobation that it is seldom practiced, and the culprits usually shunned as wasteful and lacking that golden virtue of self-control. However, to kill a male for a good reason, or after coitus, remains acceptable, despite occasional debates on the subject. This is simply the way things are, and the conservation of tradition is important in Great Nest these days. Great Nest is a vast forest metropolis. Hundreds of square kilometres of great trees are festooned with the angled silk dwellings of Portia's kin, constantly being added to and remodelled as each peer house's fortunes advance or decline. The greatest of the spider clans dwell in the mid-level, shielded from the extremes of weather, but suitably distant from the lowly ground where those females without a peer group must fight for legroom with a swarm of half-savage feral males. In between the peer houses are the workshops of artisans, who produce that dwindling stock of items that ants cannot be bred to manufacture. The studios of artists who weave and craft and construct elegant knot script, and the laboratories of scientists of a score of disciplines. Beneath the ground, amongst the roots, crawl the interlocking networks of ants, each nest to its own specialised task. Other larger nests radiate out from the metropolis's limits, engaged in lumberjacking, mining, smelting and industrial manufacture. And, on occasion, war. To fight the other is something that every ant colony can remember how to do, if the need arises, although Great Nest, like its rivals, has specialist soldiers as well. Portia, on her way to Temple, feels fragments of current affairs falling into place within her. Yes, there have been further troubles with Great Nest's neighbours, the Lesser Nests, Seven Trees, River Chasm, Burning Mountain. They are testing the boundaries of territory once again, jealous of the supremacy of Portia's home. It is likely that there will be a new war. But Portia is not concerned about the result. Her people can muster far more ants, and far better designed ants, for the fight ahead. The sheer size of Great Nest necessitates a public transport system in the higher reaches. The central temple where Portia holds sway is some distance from the site of her lying in. She is aware that the transporting of things is the province of God, and among God's troubling, hard-to-understand plans are various means of moving from place to place at great speed. But so far no peer house, no city, has succeeded in realising any of them. The spiders have made their own arrangements in the interim, albeit with a cringing awareness that they are inadequate compared to the divine plan. Portia boards a cylindrical capsule that is strung along a thick, braided strand, and lets it carry her at a rushing speed through the arboreal glory that is her home. The motive power is partly stored energy in silk springs, a macro-engineered development drawn from the structure of spider silk itself, and partly cultured muscle. A mindless slab of contracting tissue running along the dorsal rib of the capsule, obliviously hauling itself over and over, efficient, self-repairing, and easy to feed. Great Nest is a complex interconnecting web of such capsule runs, a network amongst networks, like the vibrational communications strands that go everywhere, since the temple maintains a rigorous monopoly on the invisible traces of radio waves. Shortly thereafter, she steps into the temple, carefully marking the reactions of those she finds there, sniffing out potential challengers. "What is the position of the messenger?" she asks, and is told that the voice of God is in the skies, invisible against the daylight. "Let me speak to her." The lesser priestesses clear out of her way somewhat resentfully, having had the run of this place for a month. The old crystal receiver has been improved steadily since the messages of God became comprehensible, that being the first lesson of God, and one of the most successful. Now there is a whole machine of metal and wood and silk that acts as a terminus for a sightless strand of the great and unseen web of the universe that links all such termini, allowing Portia to speak direct to other temples across half the world and to speak to and hear the words of God. After God originally began speaking, it took the combined great minds of several generations to finally learn the divine language, or perhaps to negotiate that language, meeting the comprehension of God halfway. Even now, a certain amount of what God has to say is simply not something that Portia or anyone can understand. It is all set down, though, and sometimes a particularly knotted piece of scripture will yield to the teasing of later theologians. Slowly, however, a rapport with the Godhead was established by Portia's forebears, and a story was thus told. Late in the development of their culture, therefore, Portia's people inherited a creation myth, and had their destiny dictated to them by a being of power and an origin that passed all their understandings. The messenger was the last survivor of an earlier age of the universe, they were told. In the final throes of that age, it was the messenger who was chosen to come to this world and engender life out of the barren earth. The messenger, the goddess of the green planet, remade the world so that it would give rise to that life, next seeded it with plants and trees, and then with the lesser animals. On the last day of the previous age, at the apex of creation, the messenger dispatched Portia's distant ancestors to this world and settled back to await their voices. And after so many generations of silence in which the messenger's voice alone touched the strands of that invisible world-spanning web, the temples now sing back, and the balance of God's plan is parceled out in piecemeal revelations that almost nobody can yet understand. The messenger is trying to teach them how to live, and this involves building machines to accomplish purposes that Portia's people can hardly grasp. It involves dangerous forces, such as the spark that sends signals up the strands of the ether to the messenger, but of a vastly greater power. It involves bizarre, mind-hurting concepts of nested wheels and eyes, fires and channeled lightning. The messenger is trying to help them, but its people are unworthy, so preaches the temple. Why else would they fail their God so often? They must improve and become what God has planned for them, but their manner of life and building and invention is wholly at odds with the vision that the messenger relates to them. Portia and her sisters are often in contact with the temples of other cities, but they are nevertheless drawing apart. God speaks to each of them, each temple being assigned its own frequency, but the message substantially the same, for Portia has eavesdropped on God's dictates to others before. Each temple translates the good news differently, interprets the words and co-opts them to fit with existing mental structures. Worse, some temples are losing their faith entirely, beginning to recast the words of the messenger as something other than divine. This is a heresy, and already there has been conflict. After all, that tiny point of moving light is their only connection to a greater universe which, they are told, they are destined to inherit. To question and alienate that swift star could leave them abandoned and alone in the cosmos. By the end of the day, between reports and the understanding the male has just gifted to her, She has caught up with what has transpired in her absence. Friction with the apostate Seven Trees Temple is high, and there has been serious infringement at the mine sites. The demands of God mean that raw materials, metals especially, are in high demand. Great Nest has maintained a monopoly of all good veins of iron and copper, gold and silver, anywhere near its ever-extending reach. But other cities constantly dispute this by sending their own ant colonies out in column to raid the workings. It is a war where the weapons, so far, have been more efficiently bred miners rather than fiercer warriors. But Portia is aware that this cannot continue. God herself has stated, in one of those long philosophical diatribes she is partial to, that there is always a single end point to conflict, if neither side will pull back from the brink. Spider has always killed Spider. From the start, the species has had a streak of cannibalism, especially female against male, and they have often struggled for territory, for local dominance. Such killings have never been casual or common, however. The nanovirus that runs through each of them forms another web of connections, reminding each of the sentience of the other. Even males partake. Even their little deaths have a meaning and a significance that cannot be denied. Certainly, the spiders have never fallen so far as to practice widespread slaughter. They have reserved their wars for defending themselves against extra species threats, such as that long-ago war against the ant supercolony that in the end proved such a boost for their technology. For a species that thinks naturally in terms of interconnected networks and systems, the idea of a war of conquest and extermination, rather than a campaign of conversion, subversion, and co-option, does not come easily. God has other ideas, however, and the superiority of God's ideas has become a major point of dogma for the temple. After all, why would anyone need a temple otherwise? When she is finally on top of developments, both theological and political, when she has been capsuled out of the city limits to visit the divine workshops where her priest engineers labour to try and make real something, anything, from God's perplexing designs, only then does she find time for a personal errand. For Portia, personal and priestly are almost always interwoven. But in this she is indulging herself, finding time to meet with one little mind amongst so many, and yet such a jewel of clarity. Several of the key moments of epiphany, in which God's message was untangled even slightly, have originated with this remarkable brain. And yet she feels a tug of shame in spending her time in travelling to this little remarked laboratory, where her unacknowledged protégé is given the chance to experiment and build without the rigid control that the temple traditionally exerts. She enters without fanfare, finding the object of her curiosity studying the latest results, a complex notation of chemical analysis woven automatically by one of the ant colonies of the city. Interrupted by her presence, the scientist turns and waves palps in complex genuflection, a dance of respect, subservience, and pleading. "Fabian," she addresses him, and the male shivers and bobs. Before coming here, Portia has been to the outer laboratories to view the progress on God's plan, and she is not heartened. The history of the messenger's contact with her chosen is the enactment of a plan. Once the language barrier was breached, as it is still being breached, missive to missive, God wasted no time in establishing her place in the cosmos. There was at the time some debate amongst the scholars, but against a voice from the stars that promised them a universe grander than anything they had imagined, what could the skeptics suggest? The fact of God was inarguable. That it served the temple to argue God's corner is something Portia is aware of. She is aware that the first reaching out to God was a defying of temple edicts of the time. Now she finds herself wondering what might happen if the Great Nest Temple itself once again defied God. Unfortunately, the most obvious answer is that God would simply gift more of her message to other temples and not to Great Nest. A unity of religion has led to a rivalry and factionalism between the Nests. In all their long histories, they have worked together, kindred nodes on a world-spanning continuum. Now divine attention has become a resource that they must squabble for. Of course, Great Nest is preeminent amongst the foremost favourites of God, with its own knot of frequencies with which it monopolises much of the message. Pilgrims of other nests must come begging for word of what it is that God wants. Only those of the inner temple are uncomfortably aware that the message they distribute to those petitioners is merely a best guess. God is at once specific and obscure. Portia has viewed the best efforts in those high-risk laboratories outside the city. They're distant because they must be surrounded by a firebreak. God is in love with the same force that burns in the radios. The ants there smelt vast lengths of copper that carry pulses of that tame lightning just as silk can carry simple speech. Except that the lightning is not so easily tamed. A spark is often all it takes to birth a conflagration. The temple scientists try to build a network of lightning according to God's designs, but it achieves nothing, save occasionally to destroy its own creators. Somewhere out there, Portia fears, some other community may be closer than Great Nest to achieving God's intent. God's work is not to be entrusted to males, but Fabian is special. Over the last few years, Portia has become curiously reliant on his abilities. He is a chemical architect of surpassing skill. It is the age-old limiting factor. The ants are slow. The scientific endeavour of each spider nest rests on its ability to train its ant colonies to perform needed tasks, manufacturing, engineering, analysis. Whilst each generation has become more adept, pushing the boundaries of their organic technology, each fresh task requires a new colony, or else for a colony's existing behaviour to be overwritten. Spiders like Fabian create chemical texts that give an ant colony its purpose, its complex cascade of instinct that allows it to perform the given task. Although in truth, there are few like Fabian, who accomplishes more elegantly and in less time than any other. Fabian possesses everything a male might desire, and yet he is unhappy. Portia finds him a bizarre mix, a male whose value has made him forthright enough that she sometimes feels she is dealing with a competing female. Before she retired to Molt, he was hinting that he was on the brink of a great advance. And yet a month later, he has not broached the subject further with any of her subordinates. She wonders if he has saved it all for her. They have a complex relationship, she and Fabian. He danced for her once, and she took the gift of his genetic material to add to her own, so as to gift their combined genius to posterity. He has learned a great deal more since then that he has not passed on. In truth, she should wait for him to petition her. But now she is here, the subject has come up. "I'm not ready," he replies dismissively. "There is more to learn." "Your great discovery," she prompts. Fabian is a volatile genius. He must be handled with a care normally unbecoming in dealing with a male. "Later. It is not ready." He's agitated, twitchy in her presence. Her scent receptors suggest that he is quite ready to mate, so it is his mind that is holding him back. "Let us get it over with now," she suggests, "or perhaps simply distill your new understandings. Whilst I do not want anything to happen to you, there are always accidents." She had not intended a threat, but males are always cautious around females. He becomes quite still for a moment, save for a nervous fidgeting of his palps, an unconscious plea for his life that goes back through the generations to before their kind ever developed language. "Osric is dead," he tells her, which she was not expecting. She cannot place the name, and so he adds, "He was one of my assistants. He was killed after a mating." "Tell me who was involved, and I shall reprimand her. Your people are too precious to consume in such a way." And Portia is genuinely displeased. There remains a tight faction of ultra-conservatives in Great Nest that believe males can have no genuine qualities that are not simply a reflection of the females around them. But that hard-line philosophy has been dying out ever since the plague, when a simple lack of numbers saw males assume all manner of roles normally reserved for the stronger sex. Other city-states, like Seven Trees, have gone even further, given the far greater ravages of plague there. Great Nest, originator of the cure, has combined cultural dominance with a greater social rigidity than many of its peers. "The improved mining architecture has been completed," Fabian drums out distractedly. You are aware that I myself may be killed any day. Portia freezes. Who would dare so tempt my disapproval? I don't know, but it may happen. If the meanest female is killed, that is a matter for investigation and punishment, just as if someone were to damage the common ground of the city or to speak out against the temple. If I am killed, then the only crime the perpetrator commits is to displease you. And I would be displeased greatly, and that is why it will not happen. You need not fear, Portia explains patiently, thinking, males can be so highly strung. But Fabian seems oddly calm. I know it will not happen so long as I retain your favour, but I am concerned that it can happen, that such things are permitted. Do you know how many males are killed every month in Great Nest? They die like animals down in the lower reaches, Portia tells him. They are of no use to anyone save as mates, and not even as mates of any substance most of the time. That is not something you need to concern yourself with. And yet I do. Fabian has more he wants to communicate, she can tell, but he stills his feet. You are worried that you may lose my favour? Keep working as you are, and there is nothing in Great Nest you will not have, Portia assures the fragile male. No comfort and no delicacy shall be denied you. You know this. He starts to phrase a response. She sees the emerging concepts strangled, stillborn, as he overrides the trembling of his palps. For a moment she thinks he will enumerate the things he cannot have, no matter how favoured, or that he will raise the point, again, that all he can have he can attain only through her or some other dominant female. She feels frustrated with him. What does he want exactly? Does he not realise how fortunate he is compared to so many of his brothers? If only he was not so useful. But it is more than that. Fabian is a curiously appealing little creature, even aside from his concrete achievements. That combination of understandings, impudence and vulnerability makes him a knot that she cannot stop pondering. She must some day tease him out straight, or cut him through. After that unsatisfactory confrontation with Fabian, she returns to her official duties. As a senior priestess, she has been asked to examine a heretic. From radio communications with other temples, she is aware that other nests display varying tolerances for outspoken heresy, depending on the strength of the local priesthood. There are even those nests, some worryingly close, where the temple is a shadow of its former strength, so that the city's governance depends on a collusion of heretics, lapsed priests, and maverick scholars. Great Nest itself remains a cornerstone of orthodoxy, and Portia is aware that even now there are plans to exert some measure of forceful persuasion on its recusant neighbours. This is a new thing, but God's message can be interpreted as supporting it. The messenger grows frustrated when her words are ignored. Within Great Nest itself, the seed of heresy has recently taken root within the very scientists the temple relies on. The mutterings of artisan females who have lost temple favour, or vagrant males fearful for their worthless lives, are easy to ignore. When Great Nest's great minds start to question the dictates of temple, important magnates such as Portia must become involved. Bianca is one such. A scientist, a member of Portia's peer group, a former ally. She has probably entertained heretical views for a long time. Implicated by another wayward scholar, an unannounced search of Bianca's laboratories demonstrated how her personal studies had veered onto astronomy, a science particularly prone to breeding heretics. Portia's kind are hard to imprison, but Bianca is currently confined to a chamber within the tunnels of a specialist ant colony bred for this purpose. There is no lock or key, but, without adopting a certain scent, changed daily, she would be torn apart by the insects if she tried to leave. The ant gatekeepers of the colony receive the correct code pheromone from Portia and douse her with today's pass scent. She has a certain period of time in which to conduct her business, after which she will become as much a prisoner as Bianca. She feels a stab of guilt over what she is about. Bianca should have been sentenced by now, but Portia is steeped in memories of her sister's company and assistance.
To lose Bianca would be to lose a part of her own world. Portia has abused her authority just to gain this chance to redeem the heretic. Bianca is a large spider. Her palps and forelegs dyed in abstract patterns of blue and ultraviolet. The pigments are rare, slow and expensive to fashion, so to sport them displays the considerable influence, an intangible but unarguable currency, that Bianca until recently could muster.
"Hail, sister!"
Bianca's stance and precise footwork give the message a barbed emphasis.
"Here to bid me farewell?"
Portia, already ground down by the vicissitudes of the day so far, hunches low, foregoing all the usual physical posturing and bluster. "Don't drive me away. You have few allies in Great Nest now."
"Only you?"
"Only me." Portia studies Bianca's body language, seeing the larger female change stance slightly, reconsidering. "I have no names to reveal, no others to betray to you," the accused warns the Inquisitor. "My beliefs are my own. I do not need a brood around me to tell me how right I am." Leaving aside the fact that many of Bianca's accomplices have already been seized and sentenced under the temple's authority, Portia has already decided to abandon that line of inquiry. There remains only one thing at stake.
"I am here to save you."
"Only you, sister." Bianca's palps move slightly, an unconscious expression of interest, but she says nothing. "I do not wish a home that I cannot share with you," Portia tells her, her steps and gestures careful, weighty with consideration. "If you are gone, there will be a hole torn in my world, so that all else falls out of shape. If you recant, I will go to my fellows at Temple, and they will listen to me. You will fall from favour, but you will remain free."
"Recant?"
Bianca echoes.
"If you explain to Temple that you were mistaken or misled, then I can spare you. I shall have you for my own, to work alongside me."
"But I am not mistaken." Bianca's movements were categorical and firm.
"You must be.
If you turn lenses on the night sky, lenses of the strength and purity that we can now produce, you will see it too," Bianca explains calmly.
"That is a mystery that cannot be comprehended by those outside Temple,"
Portia reprimands her. "So say those inside Temple. But I have looked. I have seen the face of the messenger, and measured and studied it as it passes above. I have set out my plates and analysed the light that it seems to shed, light reflected from the sun only. And the mystery is that there is no mystery. I can tell you the size and speed of the messenger. I can even guess at what it is constructed from. The messenger is a rock of metal, no more."
"They will exile you," Portia tells her. "You know what that means?"
For females do not kill other females anymore, and the harshest sentence of Great Nest is to deny the accused that metropolis's wonders. Such felons receive a chemical branding that marks them out for death if they approach any of the city's ant colonies, and many other colonies beyond, as the mark does not discriminate. To be exiled all too often means a return to solitary barbarism in the depths of the wilds, forever retreating before civilization's steady spread. "I have taken on many understandings in my life," Bianca clearly might as well not have heard. "I have listened to another messenger's incomprehensible signals in the night. The thing you call God is not even alone in the sky. It is a thing of metal that demands we make more things of metal. And I have seen it. How small it is." Portia skitters nervously, if only because, in her lowest hours, she herself has played host to similar thoughts.
"Bianca, you cannot turn away from the temple. Our people have followed the words of the messenger since our earliest days, from long before we could understand her purpose. Even if you have your personal doubts, you cannot deny that the traditions that have built Great Nest have allowed us to survive many threats. They have made us what we are."
Bianca seems sad.
"And now they prevent us from being all that we could be," she suggests. "And that is at the heart of me. If I were to cut myself away from it, there would be nothing left of me. I do not just feel Temple is mistaken. I believe that Temple has become a burden. And you know that I am not alone. You will have spoken with the temples in other cities, even those cities that Great Nest is hostile to. You know that others feel as I do. And they will be punished in turn, Portia tells her, as will you. Chapter 5.3 Old Friends. Four of them met in an old service room that seemed to represent neutral ground in the midst of those parts of the ship claimed by the various cliques. Lane and the other two all had retinues who waited outside, eyeing each other nervously like hostile soldiers in a cold war. Inside, it was a reunion. Vetus hadn't changed. Holston suspected that, overall, she had not been out of the freezer much longer than he had, or perhaps she just wore the extra time well. A neat, trim woman, with her feelings buried sufficiently deep that her face remained a cipher. She wore a ship suit, still, as though she had stepped straight from Holston's memories without being touched by the chaos that the Gilgamesh was apparently falling into. Lane had already explained how Vetus had been enlisted by Guyon to help with the uploader. The woman's thoughts on this were unknown, but she had come when Lane got a message to her, slipping through the circles of Guyon's cult like smoke, shadowed by a handful of her assistants. Cast looked older, closing in on Holston's age. His beard had returned, patchy, greying in uneven degrees, and he wore his hair tied back. A rifle was slung over his shoulder, barrel downwards, and he had come in armour, a full suit of the kind that Holston remembered him favouring before. Good against Lane's gun, perhaps not so much against a knife. His technological advantage was being eroded by the backwards nature of the times. He was also working with Guyon, but Lane had explained that Cast was something of a law unto himself these days. He controlled the ship's armoury, and only he had ready access to firearms in any quantity. His security detail and whatever conscripts he had enlisted were loyal to him first and foremost. And so was he, of course. Cast was Cast's chief priority, or so Lane believed. Now the security chief let out a loud bark of what sounded like derision. "You even broke the old man out of his grave for us. That's sick for nostalgia, Lane. Or maybe for something else." "I broke him from a cage in Guyon's sector," Lane stated. "He's been there for days. I guess she didn't know." Cast glowered at her, then at Holston himself, who confirmed it with a nod. Even Vetus seemed to be unsurprised, and the security chief threw up his hands.
"Nobody tells me fucking anything," he spat. "Well, well, here we all are. How fucking pleasant. So how about you speak your piece?"
"How have you been, Cast?" Holston asked quietly, wrong-footing everyone, including Lane.
"Seriously?"
The security chief's eyebrows disappeared into his shaggy hairline.
"You actually want to do the small talk thing?"
"I want to know how this can possibly work, this... what Lane's told me is going on." Holston had decided on the way over that he was not merely going to be the engineer's yes-man. "I mean, how long has this been going on for? It just seems insane. Guyon's got a cult? He's been futtering with this upload thing for, what, decades? Generations? Why? He could just have brought this business before the key crew and talked it over." He caught an awkward look shared between the three others.
"Or... right, okay, so maybe that did happen. I suppose I wasn't key crew enough to be invited." "It wasn't as though anyone needed anything translated," Cast said, with a shrug.
"At the time, there was some considerable debate," Vetus added crisply. "However, on balance, it was decided that there was too much unknown about the process, especially its effect on the Gilgamesh's systems. Personally, I was in favour of experimentation and trial."
"So what, Guyon just set himself to wake early, got a replacement tech crew out of cargo, and started work?"
Holston hazarded.
"All in place when he woke me. And frankly, I don't pretend to understand the technical arguments," Cast shrugged. "So he needed me to track down people who were escaping from his little prison camp cult thing. I figured the best thing I could do was look after my own people and make sure nobody else got hold of the guns. So, Lane, you want the guns now? Is that it?
Lane cast a glance at Holston to see if he was about to go off on another tangent, then nodded shortly.
I want the help of your people. I want to stop Guyon. The ship's falling apart. Any more and the main systems are going to be irretrievably compromised.
Says you, Cast replied.
Guyon says that once he actually does the thing, then everything goes back to normal. But he'll be in the computer or some copy of him, and everything will run as sweet as you like.
And this is possible, Vitas added. Not certain, but possible. So we must compare the potential danger of Guyon completing his project with that of an attempt to interrupt him. It is not an easy judgment to make.
Lane looked from face to face. And yet here you both are, and I'll bet Guyon doesn't know.
Knowledge is never wasted, Vitas observed calmly.
And what if I told you that Guyon's withholding knowledge from you?
Lane pressed.
How about transmissions from the moon colony we left behind? Heard any of those lately?
Cast looked sidelong at Vitas.
Yeah? What have they got to say?
Fucking little. They're all dead. Lane smiled grimly into the silence that generated.
They died while we were still on our way to the Grey Planet system. They called the ship. Guyon intercepted their messages.
Did he tell any of you?
He certainly didn't tell me. I found the signals archived, by chance.
What happened to them? Cast said reluctantly.
I've put the messages up on the system where you can both access them. I'll direct you to them. Be quick, though. Unprotected data gets corrupted quickly nowadays, thanks to Guyon's leftovers.
Yeah, well, he blames you for that.
Or Kern, sometimes, Cast pointed out.
Kern? Holston demanded.
The satellite thing?
It was in our systems, Vitas remarked. It's possible it left some sort of ghost construct to monitor us. Guyon believes so.
Her face wrinkled up just a little.
Guyon has become somewhat obsessed. He believes that Kern is trying to stop him. She nodded cordially to Lane.
Kern and you.
Lane folded her arms.
Cards on the table. I see no fucking benefit to Guyon becoming an immortal presence in our computer system. In fact, I see all manner of possible drawbacks, some of them fatal, for us, the ship, and the entire human race. Ergo, we stop him. Who's in?
Holston's with me.
Well, shit. If you've got him, why do you need the rest of us? Cast drawled.
He's key crew.
Cast's expression was eloquent as to his opinion of that.
And is that it for me? I'm just here to add my minuscule weight, unasked, to Lane's argument?
Holston considered morosely.
I confess that I am curious as to the result of the Commander's experiment. The ability to preserve human minds electronically would certainly be advantageous, Vitas stated.
Planning to become Bride of Guyon?
Cast asked, startling a glare from her.
Cast? Lane prompted. The security chief threw his hands up.
Nobody tells me anything. Not really. People just want me to do stuff and they're never straight with me. Me? I'm for my people. Right now, Guyon's got a whole bunch of weirdos who've been raised from the cradle on him being the fucking messiah. You've got a handful of decently tooled and trained lads and lasses here, but you're not exactly the fighting elite. Take on Guyon, and you'll lose. Now, I'm not a fucking scientist or anything, but my maths says why should I help you when I'll likely just get my people hurt?
Because you've got the guns to counter Guyon's numbers.
Not a good reason, Cast stated.
Because I'm right, and Guyon's going to wreck the ship's systems by trying to force his fucking ego into our computers.
Says you.
He says differently, Cast replied stubbornly.
Look, you reckon you've got an actual plan, as in an actual plan that would have a chance of success and not just let Cast do all the work? Come to me with that, and maybe I'll listen. Until then, he made a dismissive gesture. You've not got enough, Lane. Not chances, nor arguments either.
Then just give me enough guns,
Lane insisted.
Cast sighed massively. I only really got as far as making one rule. Nobody gets the guns.
You're worried about the damage Guyon will do with this thing he wants to do? Well, I don't get any of that. But the damage when everyone starts shooting everyone else, and all sorts of bits of the ship too, yeah, that I understand. The mutiny was bad enough. Like I say, come back when you've got more. Give me disruptors, then. The security chief shook his head. Look, sorry to say it, but I still don't think that'll even the odds enough for you to actually win. And then, Guyon's not exactly going to be scratching his head about where all your dead people got their toys from, eh? Get me a proper idea. Show me you can actually pull it off. So you'll help me if I can show you I don't actually need you. He shrugged. We're done here, aren't we? Let me know when you've got a plan, Lane. He turned and lumbered off, the plates of his armoured suit scraping together slightly. Lane was